From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a team from Columbia University examines Wisconsin's approach to juvenile justice.
Plus, for the first time, Milwaukee Magazine honors someone as the city's best chef, and we learn what makes him so good.
He has that ability, I'm guessing a lot of really great chefs do, to be able to see that in their mind. I can see how that is going to work with this and what this is going to look like in the end. Kind of like a painter is looking at a canvas, or a writer is like seeing how that story is going to play out.
And the River West band Pay the Devil brings us their version of bluegrass, a genre they affectionately call punk grass or riot grass.
I tend to think of this group as kind of like getting some of our energy from early punk rock music, where it's not flashy and it just kind of goes, you just kind of hit the gas and go forward. And I think that's like part of our appeal.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. For the past year, a team of Columbia University researchers has been looking at a landmark juvenile justice initiative in New York City called Close to Home. Close to Home began in 2012 as a five-year pilot program that allows juveniles to stay in small group homes closer to their communities rather than in locked facilities in upstate New York. What researchers found was Close to Home was in many ways a success.
Researcher Vidyatha Anunthakrishnan from Columbia University's Justice Lab and Charlene Moore, the director of Youth Justice Milwaukee, sat down with WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar to learn about what Wisconsin can learn from the story of juvenile justice in New York.
I am actually an advocate, a grassroots organizer. My background has been solely centered around working with high school age young people.
I'm Vidya Anunthakrishnan, and I am the director of Youth Justice Initiatives at the Columbia University Justice Lab, where we're really working on shaping justice for the future. And what that means in our youth justice work is really to look at ways to really end the sort of punitive youth prison model. And the work that we're doing right now is really about disseminating information and helping folks leverage that information to do that in different places. And one of the ways we did that in the last few months was put together this case study looking at what New York did, and specifically New York City, to kind of transform its juvenile justice system. And we think that's going to be really valuable, particularly in a place like Milwaukee, which in many ways mirrors where New York was 10 years ago. We know that, like, Wisconsin has been sort of grappling with a crisis in the juvenile prisons at the state level, and that there's been a lot of discussion about what should happen and bringing the kids home. In part because many of those kids are, in fact, Milwaukee kids. And the same was true, again, like in New York many years ago. And there was just this question. It was this moment to sort of really consider, like, what do we want to be? Are we going to sort of continue on this path? Are we basically going to recreate what we had at the state level, at the city level, or are we going to do something different? And I think Milwaukee is in a similar position right now to really ask that question and think through what the implications are. Like, we have a moment. We're at a different point in time than we've been in for a long time. And we can make this a transformation.
So there's this claim that there are similarities between the case in New York and where Milwaukee is currently. Could you guys talk to me about those similarities? Because I've lived in both places, and I feel like that's apples and oranges.
Mm. Yeah.
So talk to me about the similarities.
I guess when I say that, I'm really talking about kind of the circumstances when we're talking around juvenile justice. And so specifically, you know, thinking about the fact that years ago, even in 2010, crime had been sort of dropping overall. Juvenile crime had been dropping. And in terms of the numbers of kids who were getting sent to youth prisons, that was sort of going down. It was something like a drop of 56 or 57% over the span of 8 years. But who was still going were kids from New York City. And most of those beds were all upstate. A very similar set of circumstances, I think, seems to be evolving here, where I think the numbers are down and the number of kids who are actually getting placed is way down. But they're still pretty much going to this one facility that's sort of far away. And so I think this notion that, you know, that's an expensive thing to do. And it was very expensive in New York, and I think it's very expensive here. It just raises a lot of questions around what are we getting for that? And there's been a lot of documentation of poor outcomes. I know that there's been a lot of stories here in the news around that. And there were tons of stories that were happening in New York. There were a lot of really damning reports that had come out at the same time that really quantified the kinds of abuses happening. And so it just became this sort of rallying cry. There was suddenly this intense visibility around it.
Mm-hmm. So I want to turn a question over to you who have been an activist here in Milwaukee. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that. Talk about juvenile justice in Milwaukee for our listeners who are not familiar, and you can bring them up to speed about kind of the problems that we're facing right now in Milwaukee, and especially Governor Evers and what he has brought to the conversation recently.
Yeah, I have to say, and just reiterate what Vidya said, as far as we're at such a critical moment right now where we can do what is best for all the children in the state of Wisconsin. And I love that Governor Evers comes from an education background because he understands young people. He understands children, and he understands what it is that children need. I think this is the opportunity for us to really start having conversation about what's best for it. And, you know, so having other folks that have done work outside of the state saying, you know what, we've done this, and this has, you know, provided some great results. You all should try the same thing, right? It's that moment where we can now converge in time to say we have to start doing some things differently because the outcomes, particularly for Black and brown children, has just not been the same for white children. Even though crime has decreased over the last several years, the disparities has still been existent with Black and brown children. And so we want to make sure that we're acknowledging that, okay, this is definitely a moment, but let's make sure that we're, you know, looking at the elephant in the room. So when we look at the state of Wisconsin and specifically zoning in on Milwaukee and looking at the legislation that transpired, Act 185, to close down Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. So Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes is our youth prison. Lincoln Hills is for boys, Lincoln Hills School for Boys, and Copper Lake School for Girls. Those two facilities are in Irma, Wisconsin, which is about 3.5 hours from, specifically from Milwaukee.
And why is that a big deal? Why is that problematic?
Absolutely. So when you think about a space that is so far, so if you think about 3.5 hours there, 3.5 hours back, that's a 7-hour transportation. And if you're taking, if the state also has a bus that goes from county to county on particular days and picks up families to bring them out there, that trip is even longer, right? So that is an absolute problem because young people are away from their families and those close connections that they typically would have to support them while they're supposed to get the support and opportunity and services that they need. They're unable to get that on a regular basis. So being so far away from the people that you love and care about you the most, that's a problem, especially when it comes to the rehabilitation of a young person. In addition, some of the things that were happening at Copper Lake and Lincoln Hills, the abuse that was happening with young people, you know, we're talking about a system that has failed so many children over the last several decades. And having people that don't come from a youth development framework, that don't know how to work with young adolescent, right? We all remember being young once before. And you think about what is it that you needed? Think about the things that you were involved in. Think about the things that made you successful and think about the things that didn't. Think about growing out of some of those behaviors, because I'm sure some of our listening audience would look back and, you know, put their hand on their head and be like, whew, yes, I'm glad I grew out of that, right? So young people need a level of support, but they also need trained individuals that also resemble them, that look like them, that understand their circumstances and where they're coming from in order to provide that opportunity for them to learn from some of their behaviors.
So what happened in New York?
Well, a lot of it came down to that political will. Mayor Bloomberg decided on this, that there was a point where he said, we want to take the kids back. And so it sort of sprang into action, this committee in New York City, to really look at how we could do this differently. Let's start sort of planning a new response. And that's what they did. They brought together lots of different folks around the table, including the heads of the Administration for Children's Services and the Probation Department, which includes Vinnie Schiraldi, who is our co-director at the Justice Lab now. But all of these folks were sort of around the table talking very openly about, like, what do we want? Where mm-hmm. do we want to go? And who do we want coming into our system? And what does that mean in terms of what we have to have in the community? And so basically it was a year-long process of kind of planning this out and drawing on experts to help inform that. A lot of this conversation centered around, you know, what does it really mean to have kids come into our system, and who needs to be there, period. And so there's a lot of attention paid on just what the processes even are for making a decision around who goes to a youth prison and who doesn't, and sort of structured decision-making that came into play at the court level around that. And then separately, a whole conversation about alternatives. So it wasn't just about brick-and-mortar buildings, right? And I know there's a lot of attention being paid right now to the facilities that will be built in Milwaukee, or at the state level, having beds in Milwaukee or other non-secure beds that'll be in Milwaukee. In New York, this conversation was not just about beds. It was very much about, what do we need in communities that can support kids with their families in their own homes without the use of incarceration? And so a lot of this planning committee focused on developing those alternative programs and supports. And to some degree, if you answer the question about who even needs to be in the system, some of those kids, you know, there may really reasonably be an argument to be made that they could sort of have some supports and not need to actually go away, right? And to stay close to home and be working with the family as well. And that's what happened. There was a huge investment made in a lot of those programs.
So my final question for you both, as an activist, as a person who is involved with community here in Milwaukee, this is your issue, and you feel we're at a unique moment. Are you optimistic or are you pessimistic?
Always optimistic. I always see the glasses being half full versus being half empty.
All right. You have experience looking at this thing. You saw the case of New York. As you said, they're still evolving. Do you think Milwaukee is on the precipice of something? Are you optimistic or are you a little bit more skeptical?
No, I think there's a lot that is happening here. And like I said, I think this is a moment. Like, the, you know, things haven't yet been set in stone. And I think, you know, with all the changes that have happened politically, I think this is just a time for real questioning. And I think to the extent that folks like Charlene, but also folks at the county level, everyone can kind of come together and really think about, again, who do we want to be? You know, where do we want to end up? I'm excited.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, ladies.
Vitha Anunthakrishnan is a researcher at Columbia University's Justice Lab. Charlene Moore is director of Youth Justice Milwaukee. They spoke with WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar. And if you appreciate the local programming you're hearing during Lake Effect, now is the time to show your support today during our one-day drive.
It's a special one-day drive.
It is a special one-day drive. One day only, you have an opportunity to go to WUWM.com/give and make your contribution of support. And Mitch, there is a special gift basket going on.
There is. Everyone who makes a contribution during this special one-day drive today between now and 11:59 p.m. is entered to win a WUWM gift basket, which includes a day sponsored message. These are the sponsorships you hear periodically through the day, announcing that this is the day that you are the sponsor of WUWM programming. The gift baskets include a variety of WUWM logo wear. It could be something like a tote bag, any number of things with our name on them that are a great way to be out in the community and, you know, kind of show off with pride that we're your public radio station. We have four of them, and everyone who makes a contribution during this hour of Lake Effect throughout the day today, actually, is entered to win. But you can only do that when you make your contribution, either a sustaining membership or a one-time contribution at WUWM.com/give.
We'll take a quick break, and then Milwaukee Magazine honors for the first time someone as the city's best chef. We'll find out who it is when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM right after this.
We're back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. The initial names have been announced for chefs and institutions being considered for the annual James Beard Awards. There are several Milwaukee chefs on that list, but Milwaukee Magazine's first ever Best Chef honoree is someone who already has a Beard Award under his belt.
Justin Abrahamian is the chef owner of Milwaukee's esteemed Sanford restaurant. Despite his relatively young age, he's been at Sanford for a long time, previously under the direction of its founder, Chef Sandy D'Amato. Dining critic Ann Christensen profiles Justin in the March issue of Milwaukee Magazine, and she joins us to share what makes him a worthy winner of the magazine's first Best Chef distinction. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Why was this the right time to honor a single chef in this way?
We have always wanted to do this. This is something we've been talking about for years. I think it's just having the opportunity to do it. There were other dining stories that came, you know, that we wanted to do. And we, oh, no. We got to do this in March. We got to do this in July. I do 4 dining features a year. And we just got really serious about talking about this for our March issue. And then it became, well, who would this person be? And immediately, I mean, the person that came to mind was Justin Abrahamian of Sanford. And I thought I needed to think about other people too, but I just kept going back to Justin. There just wasn't really anybody else.
What did you take into consideration when you started weighing, you know, you would say handful of chefs in the Milwaukee area? So when you think about the criteria, what was it that Justin rose to the top?
I mean, quite a few things. I mean, he is obviously the chef owner of Sanford. He took over a long established restaurant from a James Beard Award winning chef. Justin himself has won a James Beard Award, one of very few in the city. The restaurant is known for being impeccable, consistent. That is something that he is known for as a chef and something the restaurant is known for. Also, just the idea of, and this is really important to me, somebody who is kind of a mentor in the sense of other chefs, I think, can really look up to him. He's just a genuinely good guy. You know, in an industry where we in the last year have been hearing about, you know, a lot of things that go on in the industry that are not exactly positive, you know, whether it's how women are treated in kitchens or, you know, minorities, anger, you know, drug, whatever it is. You know, Justin really, from what I've always heard, and this is something from Sandy's time, I mean, how you run a kitchen and how you treat those people comes from the top down. And that's a really important thing to him. Sandy D'Amato treated his staff like family. And Justin does that too. The staff is their family, he and his wife's family.
And his peers, the other high profile chefs and some less profile chefs in town seem to agree as well.
He. I mean, he's a chef who I've never heard any other chef in town say a bad word about him. You know, and he works with a lot of other chefs because they do collaborative dinners. I don't think he's one that's going out like drinking with other chefs. He doesn't, that's not his thing. He doesn't do that. He also has a family. But there's certainly a lot of camaraderie between certain chefs in town, which I think is an interesting story in its own right here in Milwaukee. But he's really well respected amongst his peers. And for good reason. I mean, he's a really, you know, he's in a way a rare talent, but he also just has this, you know, and when I talked to Sandy, I mean, I did a lot of phone interviews for this because I couldn't meet with Justin or any of the chefs in person, but I was on the phone, you know, just a lot. And Sandy D'Amato, who founded the restaurant, he and his wife own Goodstock Farm, which is in Hatfield, Massachusetts. So I spent some time on the phone with him catching up and, you know, finding out, well, what were these early days like when Justin just kind of got his foot in the door and he was a kid?
Literally, he literally knocked on the door.
He literally did. And it was at a time, and it was an interesting time in Sanford's history because at that point, Sandy and Angie were running Coquette Cafe at the same time. Sandy wasn't really there as much. He had a different chef de cuisine who was there more. And it was that chef, Dave Swanson, you know.
Well-known chef himself.
Well-known chef who owns a restaurant now called Braise, who hired Justin, you know? But I think, you know, once things started to change and Sandy was back in the restaurant again and David left, he really started noticing that Justin, as he said, really had the qualities. He really got it. He had not only the talent, but he had the perseverance, the focus, incredibly organized in a way that Sandy even says he learned from.
Well, and I gather this goes back even to the point before he came to Sanford, his brief stint starting as a dishwasher at Stephen Wade's Cafe while he was still a high school student.
He was a teenager
in New Berlin.
Yeah, he was a teenager. And what happened was, you know, he started out working for his uncle's catering business. You know, was thinking, well, what do I want to do? Where do I want to go? And going to college wasn't really something he was thinking he wanted to do. He ended up graduating early from his high school. You know, started to go to culinary school. Was working in the kitchen at the same time, which is what you need to do. You need those externships. And Stephen Wade's, which, you know, now it's getting to a point where people really, who remembers Stephen Wade's? I remember Stephen Wade's, you know, older people now. I mean, Stephen Wade was, he was a thing. He was an institution. He was really well respected, and his restaurant was too. And it was the most respected restaurant, I think, that Justin and his parents sort of knew about at that point in time. And that's who he approached, knew they needed a dishwasher. And that's where he started, just kind of working his way up and shadowing and learning and becoming this sponge.
The Jedi Master, as he became known.
That's Sandy D'Amato. Sandy became known as the Jedi,
The
Jedi Master. That's how Justin has referred to Sandy.
I gotcha.
He has this sort of way of just this sort of quiet mastery.
And Justin kind of absorbs all of this stuff over the course of his career.
Yes.
He has, though, you know, besides those brief years at Stephen Wade's, he's spent his entire career at a single restaurant.
Right.
Which is maybe a bit uncommon these days. How has that helped him rather than hindering him?
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. I think he was a very, at least the sense I've gotten is he was very mature for his age, probably once he started doing this and really decided this is what he wanted to do. Having a focus or a concentration and picking up skills that maybe other culinary students at that age were not. I think another thing was that he got in the best restaurant in town, Sanford. And why leave there? You know, I mean, he was learning from the best, learning from Sandy. And I think, you know, it was a sort of kitchen where you could create new opportunities and jobs for yourself. Sandy was open to that. But there was just so much to learn. You know, you could say, you know, for a lot of chefs, oh, you really need to go and spend a couple years in New York City and work for this great restaurant owner. You need to go to Europe and stage in, you know, in France for so-and-so number of years.
Stage is essentially...
Stage means like... to an unpaid internship, right. You know, for a short period of time. And he has done some short staging, but yeah, this is really unusual that you would be just at almost your entire career, one restaurant. And for him to buy that restaurant before he was even 30 or at the point, getting to that point is quite rare.
Well, so we've talked about his approach. We've talked about how he treats his employees and how he's absorbed information over the years. What distinguishes the food that he makes that makes him such an amazing chef?
Yeah, number one, it is some of the most beautifully plated, beautifully presented food I think you'll see. And there's a lot of chefs that can do that. I mean, that is not unusual. But I think he has this really incredible talent for marrying flavors and using really unusual ingredients. That is something I always think about with him. He's drawn to really, you know, unusual things that maybe you wouldn't necessarily put on a plate. And then I think he can he has that ability, which I'm guessing a lot of really great chefs do, to be able to see that in their mind. I can see how that is going to work with this and what this is going to look like in the end, kind of like a painter is looking at a canvas or a writer is like seeing how that story is going to play out. You know, I think, you know, and so that's why I think those plates that he puts together work so well, because there's so much thought and so much like test and retest and just doing it and finessing it over and over again. These are the best meals I've had in town have really been at Sanford.
So this is the first Best Chef
yes.
article, Best Chef issue. The next time this comes around, is it going to be difficult to choose someone who, I mean, do you have to retitle the award, you know, Best Chef, who is not Justin Abrahamian?
I don't know. I'm nervous. I know it's a year away, but that's going to be difficult. But we have great talent in the city. So those people are out there, you know, and everyone's different. Every chef is different. Maybe they're not Sanford, but they bring so many other things to the table. I'd love to see a woman as Chef of the Year next year. I think that would be really fun. But what I was going to say about this feature, which I found really interesting and enjoyable for me, is I haven't had the opportunity to do like a full profile of a chef for a really long time. And no one has done that with Justin either, and particularly kind of looking in on him in the years following the sale of the restaurant, you know, and how things have changed, how they've stayed the same, that sort of respect that he has for Sanford, but sort of like bringing a little bit of his own voice in there, but being really respectful of how that's done, because there are followers of this restaurant, you know, long going customers that carried over from those old days, you know. But I just think it was really interesting to kind of learn more about him, because I think there's, you know, he's a very humble person and quiet. And, you know, Sanford isn't a restaurant where you're reading a lot about them on social media. They don't put themselves out there. So I think it was a really great story to tell that hasn't been told.
Ann Christensen, so glad you told it, and we'll look forward to next year's.
Thanks.
Ann Christensen is senior editor and dining critic at Milwaukee Magazine. Her profile of Best Chef Award winner Justin Abrahamian is the cover story of the March issue. You'll find a link to more information at WUWM.com. And that is also where you can go today only to contribute to our one-day drive.
That is indeed the case. We have a special one-day drive. Your opportunity in the middle of a kind of a cold snap to say how warm you've been kept by your radio over the past few very cold months here in Milwaukee. It's a special one-day drive, and at WUWM.com/give, you can make your contribution to support us through another, hopefully, warmer bunch of months ahead.
Yes, let's hope for that. And among the things that you would be doing when you make a contribution today at WUWM.com/give is entering yourself into a drawing for a WUWM gift basket. It also includes a day sponsor message, which is where you could wish somebody a happy birthday. You can honor, you know, somebody that was a family member, your birthday, anything like that. But basically that day you are sponsoring or helping to sponsor the programming that everyone hears on Milwaukee Public Radio. And anyone who contributes is automatically enter to win one of those gift baskets and day sponsor messages. So we're hoping that we will hear from you, WUWM.com/give.
And best of all, you are supporting programming like Lake Effect that you rely on each and every day to tell you not only what news is going on, but to help you understand the culture, things like the dining scene around Milwaukee. We just spoke with Ann Christensen, but the honoree for Best Chef has been on this show as well.
Yes, he has. And it's just wonderful. Wonderful to know that we have this kind of thing going on in Milwaukee and that we're uniquely positioned to be able to present it to you if it's something you don't already know about and you learn something that makes our day. So we're hoping that you will make our day as well by going to WUWM.com/give and making your contribution of support.
We will take one last break, and then the punk bluegrass sound of the River West Band, Pay the Devil, graces our performance studio. Lake Effect returns right after this on 89.7 WUWM.
It's Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The instruments are found in your basic bluegrass band lineup, banjo, mandolin, guitar, bass, but the sound they produce in the hands of the members of Pay the Devil is way grittier than most bluegrass outfits make.
The River West Bass Band writes songs that could easily be part of the American folk tradition, but they're presented with a punk edge that keeps them from sounding like museum pieces. They have a new album coming out on Friday, so the band stopped by the studio to give us a preview. The song we're hearing is called To Hell With Luck. Pay the Devil in Lake Effect's Performance Studio with To Hell With Luck. Lady and gentlemen, it is a pleasure to have you in the studio. Back in the studio for most of you. I mean, my goodness, it's been like, what, 4 years?
Yeah. Something similar to that.
Yeah. And Jackie, you're the new kid on the block.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah. So welcome.
Thanks.
So what have you been doing in 4 years? What's been going on?
Oh, that's a really good question. What have we been doing?
Recording.
We've been recording just about that entire time. So this album that's coming out soon, we've been working on just about since then. We picked up Jackie. We picked her up 2 St. Patrick's days ago.
Standing by the side of the road.
Yeah. Two of us got married. There were 3 babies in the band.
Not to each other, no.
Not to each other.
Yeah. No, nobody's married to each other.
No one's married to each other.
We did attend each other's weddings.
But Bonnie, you would like to know this because this show actually is the reason why Jackie is with us now. Because when we played the first time, her husband, Mike, was listening and said, he knew me, and he was like, oh, I didn't know that you were in this band, Pay the Devil. And I was like, yeah, I am. And he's like, I just heard it on Bonnie North's show. And then he was like, my wife plays bass. And so then that's kind of how we got connected with Jackie.
That's
so
fantastic.
Exactly.
It's coming full circle now, you know.
So you're saying it's Lake Effect's fault?
Yes,
totally.
It's the Lake Effect, you know.
It's the Lake Effect.
I think what he's saying is that Lake Effect is to thank. Serendipitous turn of events.
About adding a wonderful bass player to the already exalted lineup.
Emphasis on exalted.
Exalted. Well, I also remember this band, of course, is the band with 2 Ivans.
Yeah, that's true.
So we should probably, other than Jackie, we should probably go down and say who everyone is because people won't remember from 4 years ago.
That's true.
So starting with this Ivan.
Yeah, I'm the guitar player, Ivan Baker. Ivan and I were the first members, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm the banjo player, Ivan Eisenberg.
I'm Jeremy Ault. I play the drum and then other percussive things.
The washboard.
Yeah, the washboard. Yeah.
Fun.
I'm Matt. I'm the mandolin player. I was Ivan's cousin. He called me one day. He's like, hey, do you want to be in a band? And I was like, yeah. And yeah, it worked out really well.
So how long has the group been together in some form or another? It's been quite a few years.
Yeah, well, you just shared that thing, right? How long ago was that?
That was 7 years ago. It was the first time we were on stage was yesterday, 7 years ago. And that was at an open mic night at Linneman's. Was our first time ever being on stage.
We didn't even have the name yet. We were still Twice as Terrible.
Yeah.
So like we had the worst pun name ever.
Yeah,
we
other
like,
Ivan
two
puns.
Ivans, Ivan the Terrible, Twice as Terrible.
Twice as Terrible. I kind of like it, actually.
Yeah. Ivan working on the railroad.
Oh, yeah, that one never stuck. Oh, that's way worse. Oh, God.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So at that Linneman show, I think, so we called in. We're like, hey, Jim, can we get a spot? Like we want to play, and he said yeah, and so over the phone we told someone to sign us up, and we got signed up as Twice as Parable, like we were some sort of
biblical group.
Yeah.
Like our name still has a biblical connotation to it.
Right.
In a different way, you know?
So yeah, we got, I think that might have killed it. Did we say like, let's get a different name? Like was that what did it?
I like it. So you went from Parable to Devil.
I kind of like that.
Accidental Parable to Devil.
I like Accidental Parable. That should be the name of your next album.
That's true. I like it.
So, and that's another Lake Effect thing. You can give us credit.
Yeah, right now the front runner for the next album, We Can League It Right Now, I think is the worst thing about a rainbow, or the worst thing about rainbows. We'll see. But
Accidental Parable is pretty good.
Accidental Parable is strong.
If we regroup as a indie rock band, I think that'd be great.
Why not? You know, lots of people play these kind of instruments. The genre lines have blended and merged, and I don't think you have to worry about that. But no, this is so firmly in bluegrass. It's one of the things I really like. But it's bluegrass with an edge. It's sort of like whiskey bluegrass. And I'm just so glad you guys are still doing it, and you've got this album coming out. I understand that it's taken almost the time since you were here last to actually get the album finally out? Because I remember we were talking about it last time.
Yeah, we were. I think we were in here like bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and we were saying things like, oh, we have the next one like half in the bag already. Like, this is...
And the best laid plans of Mice and Men. And,
it's hard.
And here you are. But you all got married, babies, you know, that kind of eats it. And working, you know, actually doing the day jobs and all of that stuff.
Yeah, unmarketable music doesn't pay that well. I think we're relatively unmarketable. So
Next album's out going to be right away, though, for sure.
Yeah, we have it half in the bag.
And in 4 years from now, when you come back, you'll say, wait, we just came to... exactly.
How many babies you guys have now?
Same number.
Yeah. Same.
One more album.
More album. Exactly. Well, let us hear another song. Tell me what you're going to play for us.
This is going to be...
Sitting Up Here.
And what's the background for this tune?
Oh, I have a good story about this one. So this song's probably from 2012, 2013,
the
impetus of the song. And it was, I think it was initially just like a, well, I'm sitting up here as like a joke, like to sort of like make fun of somebody's background singing.
Mine. Make one of my background.
Sorry, to make one of our mandolin players deciding to sing way up high. And we're like,
the high tenor. You're doing the high tenor part, huh?
It wasn't bad, but we were just like, so we're just like,
I don't do it anymore. So it wasn't bad.
It started as like a major key, like a flippant joke. And then we just kept playing it. Like the tune stuck around. And then I think as a joke one day, we shifted it to a minor key. And then it kind of wrote itself. Like, all of a sudden, it became, like, not a joke song. It sort of became a real song. And I wrote a few verses, and Ivan Baker wrote a few verses. And we cut out, like, a weird bridge. And then it was, I think it's one of our favorite songs. Mm-hmm. I think it became so it's funny. It started, you know, now with the lyrics in, it sort of, instead of telling, like, this sort of joke about singing register, it tells sort of, like, four vignettes of working class people. And I like to think that the chorus is sort of a chance to sort of take a breath and reflect on your life and realize that, like, you don't need everything to be okay. And, like, you know, like, the stories that the people are telling in the song are hard, but sitting up here for no reason, sitting up here just passing time is just sort of that, like take a breath and, like, everything's okay and you don't need to do everything, so.
Well, let's hear it. This is Pay the Devil in Lake Effect's Performance Studio with Sitting Up Here.
Cut the wood.
And that was Pay the Devil in Lake Effect's performance studio with Sitting Up Here. I like it in the minor key. And I also love, and I have to say, I don't remember this from the first time you were here, the two of you trading off, the two Ivans trading off verses, you know, because you have very different voices and it really brings something interesting to the whole song. The yeah. fact that you do that, there isn't just one lead singer.
Yeah, there was a period of time where it was summer and everybody was busy, and so it was just Ivan and I for a handful of practices in a row. And instead of just jamming like we used to, we were like, let's get some work done. And so Ivan would propose some of these songs that were just hanging there for years. So we started chipping away at them, and that's kind of how they got finished.
Yeah, and again, with both of you singing, taking turns, it's really good. And then having all of you guys coming in on the harmony stuff is really a lot of fun.
Yeah, so. Jackie's backup vocals have added a ton. So like a bunch of these songs. So that song predates, I mean, that song predates like, I don't know, almost as an old band, right? Like that's an old song, but Jackie's vocal part. Oh, it's just so nice. Cause the rest of us sort of sing like sort of work song style, right? Like all in the same octave, all in the same note, really. Like just a sort of like a group chorus. And Jackie just adds so much like texture to that.
Did you always sing and do bluegrass stuff with the bass, or were you doing other kinds of music?
I was really doing other kinds of music before this. It's been great to learn a new set of genres, not just bluegrass, but old time. And the band has a huge repertoire, especially Ivan is famous for his memory for songs, and they play a lot of traditionals from different genres, but a lot of original music. And I've really enjoyed getting to know this kind of music.
Well, and the other thing, and of course the radio audience can't see this, but Ivan, you play the banjo, but you're playing clawhammer.
Yeah.
You're doing a clawhammer style, which is an old-fashioned style of playing. It's not the three-finger Scruggs style. And so what drew you to clawhammer?
So my dad's a mandolin player. I played the guitar as a kid, like every other kid who grows up with music in the house. And I switched to banjo, like, sort of embarrassingly because there weren't that many banjo players. And I thought, like, it was a way I could maybe set myself apart from the crowd because I wasn't the best guitar player and was never going to be. So not that I'm the best banjo player, but, like, so I switched, and I didn't know that many people that played. So this gentleman, Barry Smith, from a band, I'm from Erie, Pennsylvania, and the band's from Union City, Pennsylvania, and the Tiger Maple String Band. And he played, and he learned from like a Rachel Eddy and, Richie Stearns. So Richie Stearns is in a band, The Horseflies. They're pretty popular. They're a national touring act. And it's sort of like a trance bluegrassy music. They're really good out of Ithaca, New York, if you haven't heard.
I haven't. I have to look them up now.
But he's like Barry and Richie and Rachel Eddy all sort of play this. Well, Rachel Eddy's a traditional. She's brilliant. She's great. The other two guys are too, but they just sort of play this strange, like sort of droney version of clawhammer. And that's what I was most introduced to. So playing a little bit with Barry when I was younger, I got interested in clawhammer and sort of tried to make it my own. I play a little bit of three-finger style, but yeah, almost never. There's a lot of that. You know, like I don't really want to compete with the, like, bluegrass Nashville three-finger guys. Like, there's fewer clawhammer. I'm just trying to find a small pond, and I'll just live in that pond.
I like the way it fits into what you do, too, because it's so driving. But it's driving in a different way than the three-finger style is. It's very rhythmic, but also melodic. And it works so well, Jeremy, with what you're doing, with all of that kind of old-fashioned percussion.
Yeah, I really like that you said driving. I tend to think of this group as kind of like getting some of our energy from early punk rock music where it's not flashy and it just kind of goes, you just kind of hit the gas and go forward. And I think that's like part of our appeal. I don't think we're ever going to blow anybody away with technicalities and melodies, but I think people get into music when it's as accessible and there's energy to it and it can be relatable. And I think that's what like early folk music has too. And I think we kind of get into that a little bit. And you could talk about the clawhammer banjo. You could talk about straightforward rhythms or just like straightforward strumming. I think that's definitely attractive.
Well, and you've got the flat picking going on on your side, and you've got the mandolin stuff happening. So there's a lot of traditional elements happening. But I like the idea. The punk is a really good description. It's kind of like punk bluegrass. I was thinking of what's the Boston-based band that it was like Flogging Molly that kind of took Celtic and just like added punk and rock to it. It's kind of like you're doing that for bluegrass. It's the same idea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We've been called chanty grass before. You know, like, I think that's actually quite an apt term.
I like that.
Or riot grass.
Or riot
that's
grass.
That's another good one.
Ooh, riot grass.
Kind of gets into the Riot Girl feel, too. You know, I like that as well.
Sort of anarchic, you know. That's what's really great about it is just, you feel like it's going to, like, go somewhere at any moment, but it's all...
Yeah, we always feel maybe like we're about to get off the rails, but, you know, never quite do.
Never do.
Never.
sometimes.
Sometimes we absolutely do, but it's all for fun.
Speaking of getting off the rails, in the last thing you're going to wrap up for us, you kind of go off the rails a little bit, but on purpose. So before we get to that, though, I want to thank you guys for coming in and playing for us. It's just been fantastic to see you all again, Jackie, to meet you. So what are you going to take us out with that almost goes off the rails?
This song's a Big Black Bear, and Ivan's probably better to talk about it than I am.
Yeah, so my dad wrote this song originally, most of it. I just finished it off. I was raised with a little bit of bluegrass that in the household my dad played. But this song I always thought was written by somebody else, and I went to search it some years back just after he had died, and I couldn't find it anywhere. And I felt like maybe he actually did write it and he wasn't, you know, giving me bull crap, you know. I introduced it maybe, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, and then we started adding it into the set and recorded it, and the rest is history.
All right. We're going to hear Big Black Bear and Black Bear Free For All to take us out. Lady and gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Brian. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pay the Devil is Ivan Eisenberg, Ivan Baker, Jackie Lally, Matt Givens, and Jeremy Ault. The band has an album release show Friday evening at Walker's Point Music Hall beginning at 8. There is more information at WUWM.com. And WUWM.com/give is where you can play a role in making our special one-day membership drive a success. It's already gone well, but you can make it go even better. Support programming like Lake Effect and the great bands that we bring into the studio each and every, they're not on every day, but they are a few
certainly
times
weekly.
A month. Yeah, and we'll have another one on tomorrow's show, in fact. So it's just another example of the kind of wide range of culture that Lake Effect and the station in general presents.
WUWM.com/give is the place to go. We hope that you will make a contribution. Now you have only one day to do it. We purposely shortened this, so it is in one day and one day only. And we're hoping that we will hear from you. And you'll be entered in to win. Somebody will win one of those four people will win those four gift baskets. And by making a contribution, you could be one of them.
The prize is a gift basket, which includes a number of WUWM logo items, plus a day sponsor message. And again, we have four of those. A contribution is not required to enter the drawing, but is appreciated. And everyone who makes a contribution between now and 11:59 p.m. is entered to win. So take advantage of this. We are not dragging out this drive. It is a one-day-only drive, but we can only do it with the support of people just like you. And that's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.